Today, an attempt to speak peaceably to an affirmative topic with some very negative associations.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Because about a month ago, there was a major ruling regarding affirmative action, and because I've had a few people inquire with me, I'm the president at a college, a private school, so not as directly affected by the ruling as some would be, but still directly affected in some ways, there was a ruling at the Supreme Court about affirmative action, basically bringing an end to affirmative action programs, so to speak, to using certain methods, at least with race-conscious approaches to admissions. I mean, explicitly, you can still be race-conscious, but you have to do it in some specific ways to avoid all the pitfalls that go with affirmative action, whatever. Because the Supreme Court had a ruling recently about affirmative action, sort of overturning affirmative action, some people have contacted me and said, do you think this is a good thing? You know, what's happening with it? They've asked some questions. And most of them have brought an opinion that I think is fairly, you know, widespread, I'll say. Not universal, but widespread among conservatives, certainly among white evangelicals, that affirmative action was a terrible program, that it was a terrible idea, that it needed to be overturned, that it was government overreach, that it was all of these things. And some of the critiques of affirmative action are reasonable, but most of those had been addressed already, and not everybody's aware of that. And so in having a conversation about it, just realizing how little of what has motivated and transpired regarding affirmative action over the decades since the 1950s and 60s, and even a little before that when it was becoming a major issue in our society, because of the lack of knowledge about some of the details about it, what it is, and then what's transpired with it, I thought it would be worth having a conversation about it because it is such a monument in the culture war that it is an effective way for us to back up and make sure that we haven't gotten ourselves caught in a quagmire instead of clearly thinking through, hiking through the trails that really do relate to the individuals and the parts of society that are affected by this. Instead of us just holding our ground in the swamp while the enemy's shooting at us and we're trying to defend ourselves, you know. So just trying to extract us from the culture war and have a more genuine conversation about this concept, using affirmative action, this concept, as the basis for that talk. And so first step is just to have a little background so that we're clear on what we're talking about. It's a widely divergent topic. It covers a lot of territory, but the basic concept is pretty simple. And so I want to give a little history about it, not because I'm a history buff on affirmative action. I went to history.com and used their website as sort of a timeline to make sure that I had the major points. And then I looked up other details on some of these things and events that transpired. But that's always, you know, I mean, it's a dependable resource for just basic facts, a little better than Wikipedia, you know, something like that. So anyway, part of the background is just to recognize where it comes from. And I didn't realize that the first use of the concept in a really strong action, and the first use of the term in a way that was directly related to doing what affirmative action has become, was JFK. It was his action that brought this to pass. So there was an executive order that he passed in 1961 that required, and this has become a regular path or method for sort of civil rights activity on the government's part. And it's happened on the Democrat and the Republican side. Both have done it. You'll be surprised at some of the individuals that are involved in this. But JFK, not a big surprise, right? So he was a fairly strong proponent of some civil rights actions that were going on. And I know he was a barrier and a block in some ways to things that needed to happen too. So I'm not trying to lionize the man. But there were good things that he was trying to do. And one of those came in the form of an executive order that required government contractors to put into place actions that would ensure equal opportunities for people of different races. And again, it's not a law. This is a, you know, the executive officer of the business, which is the government, saying to any contractor they're going to deal with, hey, if you apply for us and want to get a contract, one of the things we're going to look at in your business is whether you're giving equal opportunities. Of course, that becomes a key phrase after this also, but whether you're giving equal opportunities to people of different races. And apparently it was crafted by him along with a famous black lawyer, Hobart Taylor, and by the way, JFK's vice president at the time, LBJ, was also supposed to be principal informing that regulation or requirement, you know, for government contractors, that executive order. And by the way, just to mention the background of this, a long time before this, so probably 30 years before this, because FDR was the one who did it, he had signed an executive order requiring defense contractors, not all government contractors, but defense contractors, and this is the quote, to provide for the full and equitable participation of all workers in defense industries without discrimination. And you can tell that's not as strong, but, you know, for an initial effort, that's pretty substantial back in the 1930s for him to say, if you're going to have employees, whether they're black or white or Hispanic or anything else, you're going to have to treat them equally. That's a pretty strong action on FDR's part to deal with something about civil rights. So that's, you know, not quite 30 years before this, but towards the end of FDR's time. So anyway, JFK's order that he put out shortly after 1961 was the first use, where he said, this is how we're going to implement it, was the first use of the term affirmative action in that context. So this is starting in 1961 that we're talking about, where this concept becomes important. Obviously, it's right in the middle of the civil rights movement, so that's not a big surprise. That's sort of where it comes from. And the idea for JFK was that there needed to be affirmative action on behalf of those who had been somehow neglected or overlooked or mistreated or whatever else, excluded from jobs and so on, based on race, creed, color, or national origin. Those were the key concepts that he relied on to identify those who might need to be represented better. And affirmative action then becomes the way of saying, we can't just break down the old barriers that existed and say, well, you can cross if you want to. We need to take some kind of positive step to try to mitigate the barrier or close the gap, right? That's what he was doing. And so that was called an affirmative action. We're going to do something positive to make this happen. Some action, not just stop creating barriers, but create open doors and then try to get people through those doors. That was the idea of affirmative action. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is obviously passed after JFK's death, after his assassination, actually prohibited, and this becomes, the Civil Rights Act obviously becomes the basis of almost everything that's disputed now among conservatives in the efforts to create some kind of equity or equal opportunity. And again, I'm not saying there are no legitimate complaints. I'm just saying I'm not sure we have honest conversations about this. And so looking back, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was adopted in towards the end of 1963, I think implemented in 1964, applied in 1964, prohibited segregation of public spaces. We hear about that in all kinds of ways now. I mean, that's become very controversial in how extensive does this prohibition against segregation in public spaces become. If you're a church, for instance, and things like that, it's always been an issue. But it also forbid discrimination in companies that had more than 15 employees. Meaning, if you had become a place that was just hiring people on the assumption that you didn't have 15 family members you could hire for your business, you know, which obviously they didn't know the Duggars. The point is that if you had 15 employees or more, you know, you're probably hiring people off the street. At that point, they said, okay, we're going to put in the legislation that you can't exclude someone from being an employee on the basis of race, creed, color, or national origin. And so what the big difference comes in the Civil Rights Act, the big difference comes, at least in terms of employers and such, with the creation of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, because that creates a mechanism for enforcement. So suddenly this commission becomes someone, becomes an organization, becomes something that's going to review whether your business is falling in line with the regulation that's been created. LBJ is the one who signed it into law or into, you know, action into law. And MLK made a big deal of it. Martin Luther King saying it was like a second emancipation. You know, I mean, it was celebrated and it should have been celebrated. This is right in the middle of Jim Crow saying Jim Crow is illegal. That doesn't make it happen automatically, but at least it creates some avenue where it's possible, based on law, that we could start taking actions to eliminate some of these barriers that existed in our society. And the fact that those barriers existed then is enough. It should be enough for us now not to be completely uncomfortable with the idea that we create structures which impede equality. That just happens. And back then it happened in terms of law. Like, you could have restrictions on where people could walk, how they would vote, you know, and things like that, or whether they could vote, things like that. And this regulation said, you can't do that anymore. Well, you know, saying it's against the law now and taking it off the books doesn't eliminate everybody who used to enforce those laws. And the people who enforced the laws weren't enforcing it like machines who didn't care about it. They enforced the laws because they cared about the laws. And so those barriers were still there. And all of that should say to us, you know, if they were having to pass laws about this 100 years after the end of the Civil War, then it's not unreasonable to say there are barriers, there are structures, there are systems in place that maintain inequities that we have to overcome. Some of those have been thoroughly ransacked, and thank heavens for that. And some are still standing, and it's difficult to get through them. And it's a long process to find our way through it, and that's okay. We will continue to work our way through it. I would think that's what we would say in response to actions like this having been taken in the 1960s. But one of the things the Civil Rights Act of 1964 did was expand the definitions of who was included in this. And this is the point at which some people become very, very uncomfortable. But it's just part, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that you're signing the Civil Rights Act and you would say, well, there are people who are excluded not on the basis of race, creed, color, or national origin, but because they are disabled in some way, or even because they're elderly, or because of their gender, because they're a woman. And people aren't focused on getting women into collegiate athletics. 1964 is what introduces that issue, which becomes such an important part of higher education's work on trying to expand the opportunities for women in our society. And if you say, well, this is just dumb. I mean, why would you even care about this? Now, I know I'm old. I know that I'm 60 years old. So I know what I'm saying about when I was young isn't exactly the same today. That's true. It's not. But I'll give you two instances. One, while I was an undergraduate student at Baylor. When I was an undergraduate student, I had a professor who was absolutely, hands down, best professor I've ever seen of anything. Ann Miller, short story fiction, I took with her and every other English literature class I could possibly take with her. Unbelievable professor. Brilliant. Interpretation. Just off the charts. Everything I know about how to read literature really started with her. And I did have one other professor who strongly influenced me on all of that stuff, but it really started with Ann Miller. And I remember we were talking to her as a class. We were just interacting before or after class one day. and her talking about her educational experience. And she was Professor Ann Miller. And everybody called her that whole thing, Professor Ann Miller. Well, Ann, have you had Ann Miller? Have you had Ann Miller for class? It was Ann Miller. It wasn't Mrs. Miller. It wasn't Ms. Miller. It wasn't Dr. Miller. It was Ann Miller, Ann Miller, Ann Miller. And then we realized she wasn't a doctor. And so it's like, how can this woman not be a doctor? She's the smartest person in the program. And absolutely, I mean, the hardest working, just amazing person. She passed away a few years ago. Those of you who know her know what an unbelievable influence she was. Just a fantastic professor. Have I gone on enough about that? Anyway, the point is, she invested in me. So I do have a personal attachment to her commitment to teaching as well. And I've tried to be more like her in my way of teaching and trying to help other people. Anyway, the point is, she didn't have a doctorate. You know why? Because women weren't allowed into PhD programs when she was a student. They were not allowed to get a PhD in the system. Now you say, okay, but that's not the case anymore. That's true. It's not the case anymore. And thank heavens, Ann Miller was a professor who provided a model for other women after PhD programs were forced to allow women into their programs, were forced by the government to allow women into their programs. Thank heavens, other women have gone on to get PhDs in literature and everything else and to go on and become professors. But not as many as there are men who have gone into those programs, because of the history of the men who were already in those programs and already modeling career opportunities for other men in those programs. And so it's a long process for women to catch up on the numbers that are in the ranks of the academia, of the world of academia at the highest levels. And let me just add to that, that much later than that, in the early 2000s, because I didn't start teaching at Texas Women's University as an adjunct until the year 2000. And it, sometime between 2000 and 2008, I met a professor at Texas Woman's University who said the same thing, that when she had gone to university, she had gone to get to apply for a doctorate, and the professors who were there, who were in a program that had been affected by the Civil Rights Act and realized that they had to allow women and had made a policy that they had to allow women, would not allow her into their doctoral program because she was a woman. And they told her, you won't want to be in this program. It's not designed for women. And she had to fight like a dog just to get into a doctoral program strictly because she was a woman. Now, this is in the year 2000 that I'm talking about, not when she was allowed in. She was a professor already. But she was younger than I was at the time, so it had probably only been 10 years prior to that. And we're talking about in the academic world, we're talking about careers that take decades to establish. So it's not this is not something that, well, that was going on in the 60s, but it's not going on now. The residual effect of those who were excluded from these programs, whether it's based on race, creed, color, national origin, or disability, or age, or women, gender, that is, or whatever it is, they still have an effect on the population that's filling out those ranks right now. And if you say, yeah, but the legal barriers are gone, then you've forgotten the most basic truth of human progress, and that is, it's not what you know, but who you know. And you can call it a good old boy network or whatever else you want to call it, but the reality is we all fish in the pools where we, you know, where we have our boat. And if all your friends are men, then all the men are the people you're promoting, and they're all the people you're interviewing, and they're all the people whose resumes look impressive to you. And that's who you move forward, and that just makes it harder for everyone else to get through. And so that's just part of the reality of what goes on in the world right now. And I mean, that's not complicated. It's not evil. It's just part of the nature of human beings and how we function with each other. And I'm not saying it doesn't have evil consequences. There can be some evil that comes out of it. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So you can understand why passing the Civil Rights Act 100 years after the Civil War was, for MLK, the second emancipation, you know, an unbelievable opportunity. But you can also imagine why people who like things the way they were in 1963 were really uncomfortable, not only with the Civil Rights Act, based on race, creed, color, and national origin, but also its expansion to include disabled people and the elderly and women in college collegiate athletics. And what else are they going to tell us we have to accept, you know? These barriers are just breaking down. Well, that was the idea, break down the barriers. So in the 1966 Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which came out of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, began to assess in 1966, so a couple of years later, began assessing annually the progress that companies were making and government contractors were making based on reports that they required from those companies and government contractors. So in 1966, you actually start seeing annual reports from the largest companies in the country and from government contractors where they had to report and say, this is how much progress we've made in terms of racial equity in our institutions. All right, that's 1966. 1973, we're talking about things that were happening 60 and now 50 years ago. So now 1973, this is Richard Nixon, you know, Richard Nixon's Minority Business Enterprise Program, MBE, I think is how people refer to it if you've ever seen it anywhere. Creates this requirement for government contracts to be prioritized with minority-owned businesses. So this is Richard Nixon, you know, Mr. Richard Nixon, super hyper-conservative Richard Nixon, right? This guy. I mean, that's who he was. That's who he bragged about being. I'm not assaulting or criticizing or complimenting or pandering to him. That's just who he said he was. And he is the one who expands all of these acts to try to be affirmative about including people who had been excluded before to say, we're going to start prioritizing giving government contracts to minority-owned businesses. And he included in that, and later it was expanded to include, women-owned businesses. And there was also a Rehabilitation Act that took place at the same time or near the same time that required federal agencies to create affirmative action plans for hiring and placement and advancement of people with disabilities. And, this is the funniest thing because, you know, when you start and at our institution, we have looked at being affirmative about saying we are never going to exclude someone from a position because of disability or anything else. We are very positive about taking steps to make sure we take these actions. And so a few years ago, we had an opportunity to hire someone who had some disabilities, and we sat down and said, you know, this is going to be, we've got to fix some entrance, some access. And it was like, you know, do we really want to do this? Those were the questions that were being thrown around. And we just said from all the leadership, we agreed on this, from the very top, we were saying, well, of course we want to do it because if we're only realizing all these barriers exist because we really want to hire this guy who we think is going to be great, and we're recognizing now, wow, look at the barriers we have for people who have similar disabilities. Well, why are we allowing those barriers to be there for students or for other staff or for anyone else? So we should be working on these things. It is a very significant issue when you start taking on barriers to people who are being excluded that you hadn't thought about before. And it becomes this onerous government kind of intrusion on businesses when the government starts saying, well, if you're going to build a building, you've got to satisfy the requirements of these acts that have come across. So this, the Rehabilitation Act, the Disability Acts that have come up since then, they cost a lot of money to satisfy the requirements. And the reason I'm bringing all of that up is not to say it negatively or positively, but I will say it positively this way. Some of the most conservative people I've ever known who have children or relatives who have certain disabilities that then benefit from having a ramp or from having special access at facilities or from being able to provide resources for someone who's blind or someone who can't hear, all of a sudden, they're like the biggest proponents for cooperating with these requirements because it is so obvious the difference it makes in human lives that we care about because they bear the full image of God. And so it suddenly makes sense when we have someone in the realm of our peripheral vision, you know, oh, there's someone I know who's affected by this. Maybe this isn't such a bad thing. And lo and behold, it's not such a bad thing. And when it's their kid, yeah, I mean, we're talking activist now. And I admire that, by the way, not being critical at all. I admire that, that awakening, you know, to pay attention to these things. So anyway, and all, you know, all of this is happening by under the aegis of the Republican Party and Richard Nixon at the time. Although Richard Nixon took a beating from some people in his party over some of the actions that he was taking to try to include more people in these opportunities, in opening up and creating these opportunities. So, and this is important that now all of those things have extended thoroughly to people with disabilities as well, or the differently abled, as they're often described now. So, and again, a lot of these terms, you know, are from the time. So, I'm just going with the terms mostly at the time. So, here's the thing that happened though with affirmative action historically that most people don't know about. This is the main reason I wanted to give the history, was to get to this point. In 1978, something dramatic changed about affirmative action, because where it was affecting colleges and universities and admissions, and you can see how this would go directly, where you have government contractors, and then you have institutions, organizations that are being funded by government money, then they're going to be influenced by these things and so on. And after the Civil Rights Act, you know, you have requirements for schools to extend equal opportunities to prospective students and so on. And so schools were taking affirmative action seriously. And we're actually setting up quotas, just basically saying, you know, we have to have at least this number of students who are a minority or somehow, you know, race, creed, color, or national origin is different. So this was happening in California, at the University of California, when a particular student, his last name was Baki, was being excluded from attending medical school at the University of California. Yeah, it was a medical school. And so he applied several times and was rejected each time. And come to find out, he was being rejected because even though 16 other students were being accepted whose scores were lower than his scores getting into the school, the objective measures that they were using, so-called objective, I'm using air quotes and you can't see them, so objective measures of getting into the school. And we can talk about objective measures another day. I know you have questions in your mind like, well, if it was a test, of course it was objective. But, you know, tests are not all objective depending on how your education is provided when you're coming up and what's focused on in your education. So anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, this student was passed over and 16 other students that had been, 16 seats had been reserved for minority students. And he was excluded even though he had scored better than some of those 16 students who had been admitted. And so he filed a lawsuit on the basis of what came to be referred as reverse discrimination, referred to as reverse discrimination. And so, you know, this is the idea. So now I'm being excluded because I'm white. Well, that's just as racist as someone being excluded because they're black. You can understand why a person would say that. And if you're trying to get into medical school and you've done all the work to get into medical school, and then you're excluded, even though your test scores were good enough, you can understand why a person would be upset by it. I'm not saying that it's not a reasonable case to bring to court. So he brings it to court and files his objections and so on. And the court rules in his behalf that quotas shouldn't be enacted by schools to determine how many people are going to be accepted, that race could be a legitimate consideration in accepting people to a school, but you could not use quotas to exclude someone from the school. That's, as I can understand it, that's the basis of this 1978 ruling, Regents of the University of California versus Baki. You can go and look it up if you want to read about it yourself. But the point is, from that point forward, quotas were no longer the standard or the normal interpretation of what affirmative action would be. And to this day, that's what most people think affirmative action is, that it's setting some red line and saying, well, we have to have 40 black students and 20 Hispanic students and then no more than 39 white students if we're going to have affirmative action going on at our school. That's not what affirmative action is anymore. Quotas went by the wayside in 1978. I'm not saying that people haven't violated that restriction or anything like that. There've been, you know, there's plenty of wash on both sides of the main road that's been carved for us legally, where people have created abuses, both on the positive side of affirmative action and on the negative side. I mean, for it and against it of affirmative action. So that there's plenty of abuses, but let's talk about the way things are supposed to be, both legally and then morally, you know, just how we probably ought to be thinking about it. So what happened just, you know, a couple of months ago now, or a month or two ago now, was that this year in 2023, you had this case of Students for Fair Admissions, which was largely populated by Asians. That's a largely Asian group. Students for Fair Admissions opposing Harvard and UNC Chapel Hill and their practices for admissions that they felt like were excluding them on the basis of race, not because they were Asian, but because they were not one of the minorities that was focused on for admissions in those schools. So, and the ruling that came down from the Supreme Court, and this very conservative Supreme Court, was to restrict a college's use of race in admissions, which was seen as pretty much a nail in the coffin of affirmative action as affirmative action has always been known. And so for universities, it's sort of been the end of the road for it. So that's why people have been asking the questions. So now you have some of the history right in your mind, and we kind of know what we're talking about. I know that took a little while, but I think it's worth establishing the groundwork. So we're all talking about the same thing. So here's the basic argument against affirmative action is simple, and it is reverse discrimination. It is an argument that says, well, I understand why you're saying people on the basis of their race or creed, you know, so an African-American or a Jew, or saying their skin is black, and so we don't allow that here, or well, this person's from Puerto Rico, and so we're not going to give them the same opportunities. Obviously, those things are just horrible, and we don't want people doing that. So you say, so I can understand why a person would want to take affirmative action to say that if an African-American or a Hispanic has been excluded from some opportunity in the past, we want to take positive steps to open those doors for other individuals in those groups to be able to come through and to be able to succeed in ways that were precluded for them in the past. You can understand why people would say that, but you can also understand why, in the same moment, somebody who had not been excluded in the past would now look at that action and say, well, what does that do to us? And what's the result of that for my son who wants to get into that school, hence the Bakke case in University of California, and why somebody in the majority would then say, well, I mean, it's just common sense. The pie is only so big. And if you're cutting more of the pie for people who are not like me, then that means my group is now being discriminated against. You're making preliminary judgments that say we don't want as many white people as we had before. You can understand why a person would say that. I'm not making the argument. I'm just explaining what the argument is. So the reverse discrimination argument is just a basic pushback against affirmative action to say, if you turn the discrimination in the opposite direction, rather than just eliminating discrimination altogether, then you're just reversing the evil. You're not eliminating the evil. You're just creating evil on the opposite end of the spectrum. You're electrocuting people with positive ions instead of negative ions. I know I'm making up those words, whatever. You get the idea. So I even understand electricity, so I'm offended by my own metaphor there, but it'll do. Like I've got to clean it up. I'm sorry. I've done enough electrical work. I've got to clean that up a little bit. It's like you're saying, look, you have me hooked to an AC current, and because the current's going this way one second, you say it's good, and then the current reverses, which it can do 220 times a second sometimes or whatever, 60 times a second, I guess you would say normally, at 60 hertz, right? So it's reversed. Oh, now it's not evil. I don't care which way it's going. It's killing me either way. That's what the idea of reverse discrimination is saying. So the idea of reverse discrimination is to say it doesn't matter which way the racism is flowing. It's still the same thing. So what we need to eliminate is just the concept of race. Basically, ultimately, the reverse discrimination argument is rooted in the same concept that's characterized as colorblindness. If we could just stop seeing color, you know, and I wish I could count. I have no idea how many people have said this to me. Again, I'm in mostly, predominantly white evangelical settings. And so I'm going to hear a lot of this. I wish I had started keeping count when it began so that I could say 1,493 people have actually said this to me. I don't know how many it is. I could not possibly number them. They say to me after I preach on something where racism comes up, you know, something from Genesis 19 or whatever, and you know, where the topic comes up, or in Ephesians, you know, where we're talking about the mystery of the gospel and how he brings us together, wherever it happens to come up, people at the end of the sermon will come to me and they will say, you know, I don't even see color anymore. I just don't see it. I don't know what color a person is. It just it's just not a thing to me. People aren't black or white or whatever they are. You know, they're just people. And so their idea is to say, look, we shouldn't be talking about race anymore. We're just human beings. I've had people call me and say, race doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. That's a bad doctrine. There's only one race, the human race, you know, which sounds like good rhetoric, but it's just, you know, it's not a great truth or a great argument to make for a lot of reasons that we can talk about another time. The point is here, colorblindness is not, it's not as great an idea as you think it is, you know, right off the bat. And so let me just kind of clarify what's going on with the concept of colorblindness, or at least even if I don't clarify it perfectly, which, you know, I probably don't do a lot of that with anything. So I know I muddy enough of the waters as it is, but trying to clarify this a little bit, people in the majority. So, you know, in our culture and society, and the ones I'm mostly around in white churches and white society, people in the majority sometimes feel good about being able to say, look, I don't even see color anymore. And there are a couple of problems that come out of that. The first problem that with this idea, you know, with me saying, oh, I don't even see color anymore. So when I see him, I don't even realize he's black. Now, you know, saying something like that, and I understand the good motivations behind it, saying something by that, this is the first problem with it. Saying something like that implies a couple of options or a couple of ideas. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but it implies a couple of things that are a problem. Number one, it implies that there would be something wrong with recognizing that they were black. I don't even see the inferiority of this person anymore. That, you hear how insulting that sounds? And that's sort of what it sounds like when we're saying, well, I don't even see that they're black anymore. That's a problem, right? I don't have to explain why that's a problem, do I? So it's as if to say, you know, if you realized someone was black, that would be realizing there was something wrong with them, and so you shouldn't notice it. Well, I don't even see that. You know, I don't even notice it anymore. It's sort of an admission that we really do think there's something wrong, and that's an issue. The other, you know, idea that it implies that's dangerous, and this is all under the heading of the first problem with colorblindness, is that it would say that being black isn't any longer an important part of that person's history or their identity or their background. And maybe that's what that person wants you to say. Fine. That's up to every individual. They can decide whatever they want to decide about it. But, you know, for me to say, I refuse to see your history, your cultural heritage, the people you grew up with, the things that set you and your cultural history apart from me, I refuse to see those things as an important part of who you are. That could be problematic. You can see why that could be problematic with some people. And plenty of people have told me that that is a problem for them. They don't realize that I'm black. This is an important part of who I am, right? So colorblindness, not ideal for that reason. That's the first problem, that it has implications that we're not realizing when we say, oh, I don't even see their color anymore. But the other problem with colorblindness, the other big problem with colorblindness is actually this. You know, when you say your color, let's say a person could arrive at being colorblind. All it would actually mean is that you don't see your own color. that you're not, that you're saying to yourself, oh, I don't even notice that I'm painting everyone else my color. I don't even see that anymore. In other words, if a white American is colorblind, the color they can't see is their whiteness. And I'm not anti-white. I'm white. I'm mighty white. You know, I don't even know how to say it right. I just am. I'm not saying that's a, but we don't see the lens through which we see the world, which is the lens that's been created in a world that was ours. And so for us to look at the rest of the world and go, well, everybody else has an accent, but I don't have an accent. We talked about that in a different episode. For us to look at everyone else and say, well, I don't see their color is basically us saying, well, I see them as white and I don't see white anymore. Because we don't recognize the things about our culture that makes it specifically what it is, good, bad, and indifferent. We just don't see it. That's the problem with colorblindness. That's the real problem with colorblindness. The color we don't see is ours. Okay, enough of that said. So here, coming back to reverse discrimination and understanding, what I want us to do is understand the reverse discrimination argument. The idea underpinning it, colorblindness, I think is problematic. That's not really a solution for us. So let's think about it instead in terms of the way reverse discrimination would really talk about it, that somebody advocating for reverse discrimination would actually talk about it. And that would be to make the case that race-conscious decisions, like we're going to make some admissions and we're going to look at these people and this guy's white and that guy's black and all things being equal, we're going to take the black guy because we want to advocate for someone on the basis of their race. That would be a race-conscious decision. Race-conscious decisions, the reverse discrimination argument says, is unfair. That those are unfair, that is. That's the claim of reverse discrimination. That is, that it was wrong. So this is what goes with that. They would say, and I've heard this argument in terms of reverse discrimination. You would start out by saying, well, of course it was wrong for whites to exclude blacks on the basis of their color. So it must also be wrong to include blacks on the basis of their color. Now, wait, that's not actually how I hear it, but I want to say it that way first because that's the most generous way to put it. And it makes you can hear why that argument makes sense, but I'm going to undermine that in a second, and I'll put it in the real language in a moment. But the real language is much weaker, and I don't want to start there. So the reverse discrimination argument could be simply stated this way. Look, it was wrong for whites to exclude blacks on the basis of their color, so it's wrong for whites to include blacks on the basis of their color. Now, that argument doesn't work, so it doesn't get posed that way. And the reason it doesn't work is because it's like saying this. Well, it was wrong to steal from Fred, so it must be wrong to give back to Fred whatever it was you took. Well, that's so obviously ludicrous a statement. Nobody's going to give in to that kind of argument. Of course, if you took something away from Fred wrongly, you can give it back to Fred rightly, and that's the better thing to do. And if excluding someone is wrong and including them would have been right, then obviously it's not going to work in your argument to simply change the word exclude to include and say they must both be wrong, because we realize that including someone who was excluded isn't inherently wrong. So the argument doesn't get put that way. No, but nobody's silly enough to make the argument that way. So instead, we reword. Somebody who wants to advocate for reverse discrimination rewords that argument to be this. So in other words, it starts out with, well, it was wrong for whites to exclude blacks on the basis of their color. So it is wrong to exclude whites on the basis of their color. Now, that argument makes more sense. Okay, exclusion is the problem. Excluding on the basis of color is the problem. I have a color, white. I'm being excluded. That's a problem, just like it was before. So now you've reversed the flow, but it's still the same immoral principle of exclusion that's being exercised. Now, seriously, I'm not advocating for the reverse discrimination argument. I don't agree with it. But you can understand that that makes sense, right? I mean, that does make sense. If exclusion is the problem, and specifically exclusion on the basis of color is the problem, then it makes sense to object on the basis that now we're excluding people on the basis of a different color. There is truth in that argument. And again, that doesn't mean I agree with the argument. It contains some truth, though. That there is truth in this argument is apparent because anytime we're more inclusive of any group, if that can create exclusions for other groups, then it extends the problem, right? It's still exclusion happening in some way or another. And it is at least true in the short run. I mean, certainly in the immediate moment, if you say we're going to include this person, that may mean you're going to exclude someone else if you only have so many slots. Then at least in the short run, and potentially, as I was explaining earlier, because of the residual effects of who gets admitted and who doesn't get admitted, obviously you can have some long-run effects as well, and we'll talk more about that later too, then it does make sense for someone to say, well, now you're excluding white people on the basis of color. So here's where I want to pause and say, this is what we really need to address. That question. Is that a legitimate objection? And it would be, I think there are a couple of things to address about this. And the number one step would be just to say, why, if we could back up to the beginning of affirmative action and to the motivations behind affirmative action, and forget all the laws and regulations and forget whether it's been abused or implemented well or, you know, whatever all that other stuff is, just get back to the principle behind it. Is it a good idea or not? It seems obvious to me, and I'm trying to say this peaceably and generously, it seems obvious to me that on both sides, a liberal side and a conservative side, we would say, well, of course it's a good idea. Of course we can agree on some basic ideas behind it that we think are right. So, and let me just introduce enough of this, and then we will carry this forward in the next episode. But let me introduce enough of this to explain why I'm saying that. So forget the culture war approach for a minute. Just forget it for a moment. If you're on the conservative side, the culture war said you have to oppose affirmative action because it kills the free market and it eliminates any personal responsibility. It just puts all the blame on society and so on like that. If you were on the liberal side, well, then you obviously had to support, I'm saying in the culture war, then you had to support affirmative action because arguments against it were based on personal racism and hatred and selfish materialism of all these capitalists and so on. Instead, forget the culture war for just a minute, please. Just forget the culture war for a second, and let's just consider the need from the side of what a person has been deprived of in some way. Where we want to believe that everyone's born with the same opportunities, it's obvious we don't really think that. We don't really think everyone's born with exactly the same opportunities. Now, again, I'm just going to explain this in one step today, but I want to add more steps to it next time if you'll be patient enough to hang with me for it for the next episode. Why? So if you're saying to yourself, nope, everybody's got the same opportunities, America, land of freedom, land of opportunity, you don't need a leg up. You have a leg up because you were born here. You're constitutionally protected. You've got legal privilege, and people do have all of that. I grant all of that. Why do you suppose families work so hard to make more money so they can move into different neighborhoods and then assess the quality of the schools where they want to move into the neighborhood? Why do you think people try to pick the best schools for their kids? Why do they do that? Because kids in bad schools are at a disadvantage when it comes to opportunities. They're not dead. It's not that they don't have any opportunities, but they are at a disadvantage. If they're not at a disadvantage, why are so many people trying to put their kids in better schools? Why are they trying to protect that privilege of putting them in better schools? And what difference does a better school make if it's just all on your own bootstraps and giftedness? It's not. Opportunities open for you on the basis of these avenues that are created for you in better settings, better internships, better relation, whatever it is. That reality by itself should be enough to say to you, oh, yeah, I can see how if somebody was excluded from those opportunities when they were young, even if they've created some good avenues for themselves, they may not be able to create as many open doors for their kids as somebody else. And yeah, maybe that creates some persistent, some residual inequalities that need to be addressed in some way. So on the first level, you can understand why the concept of affirmative action is not a bad idea. And this is why an FDR and a JFK, but also a Richard Nixon, would have been advocating for it in the 30s, 40s, and all the way through the 70s, right? So what I want us to do is arrive at a point where we can say that our attitudes about affirmative action may be more of a reflection of old commitments that we had to the cultural war than to serious ideological differences. I have not led us down that path yet. That's where I want to go next time. And again, I want to emphasize to you, I'm not trying to say you have to give up your ideologicals, you know, the ideological commitments you have to a free market. I have those ideological commitments. You don't have to give up your ideological commitments to personal responsibility. I have those ideological commitments. But I don't think our differences on this issue are based in those ideological differences. And if we can look at the things I want to talk about in the next episode, I think we can get there. And my goal is this, first to arrive at a place where leaving some of that warrior mentality behind, we might gain a better understanding, create better conversations, establish a few better practices, and maybe even arrive at a place where we're actually a little better Christians.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.